the other camp. I don't say all the Shackmanites are social imperialists. I say half of them are already pretty frank imperialists, and the others are neutral in favor of American imperialism. Now, the Johnsonites don't want to discuss the new events because they've got all problems solved already in a closed system. That's a very comfortable position to be, to be able to stand up and say, we will not debate this, we say that, that is not important. After you've done so-and-so, then we will do so-and-so. That's all right if you like religion, where you get all problems settled at one shot, and then you don't have to worry and discuss and have any more divisions in your ranks anymore. When you say you are in complete unanimity and you don't have any discussions or difference of opinion among yourselves, that only convinces me that what you've got is not a lively political program subject to various interpretation under the stress of events. You've got a closed dogma. And I don't like dogmas. I don't like churches or popes. I had one. I got rid of him, and I don't want any more. I say the best proof of the genuine revolutionary vitality of Trotskyism is that it has all kinds of different points of view. You can see that reflected in our committee and in the convention and in the international movement. All kinds of difference of points of view, but when you boil them down, what do they amount? Different understanding of what has happened, different analysis of facts, differences as to what is the reality and what is not, but all aim to the common point of view to find what is the reality and do it honestly and admit facts when they stare you in the face, and then try to find in the new reality the basis for revolutionary action. That's why some comrades wonder, how can the discussion proceed so friendly and so comradely, and without even, as far as I know, any serious factional tendencies? Because we're striving to the same goal, and we're trying to use the same method, and I believe we'll reach that goal of a common position. Now, it's not easy, and I say it's impossible for a living political movement that's not an ossified church to answer all these complicated questions at once and with unanimity. Because the world developments are so complicated and so complex that they require investigation, they require analysis, they require information that we don't always have at hand. The basic factor in the world situation, as I see it, is that the prognosis of Marxism, that capitalism would come to grief as a result of its own contradictions, that the system would go down, and that it would be replaced by the conscious movement of the masses, which would itself be the product of these ineluctable contradictions. The first half of the Marxist prognosis is being vindicated everywhere before our eyes, that the disintegration of capitalism is taking place at a faster rate than we anticipated, and faster than the conscious movement of the workers has been able to catch up with it. That's what's taking place. But just look what has happened. If you take just the Eastern Europe alone, and Germany, and Italy, in fact, the whole world outside the United States. Only a generation ago, after the First World War, the Hungarian bourgeoisie was able to crush the proletarian revolution with its own power. The bourgeoisie of all these eastern countries were able to impose a military police dictatorship on the working class and the peasantry with their own powers and only a little help from the bourgeoisie. The German bourgeoisie was able to crush the German revolution with its own power. Now, that vitality which the bourgeoisie showed in the period following the First World War is not evident any place today. Nobody will contend for a minute that capitalism could stand up in Europe without the help of the United States economic and military, and without the help of the Trotskyists, not even in Italy or France. Now the result of this increasing disintegration of the outlived capitalist system and the failure of the conscious movement of the masses, which we are the representatives, to catch up with these objective developments, that does not stop the developments. It results in bastardized forms of many kinds. But the movement proceeds just the same. You don't get classic revolutions. You don't get perfect worker states. You get all kinds of complicated forms, but underneath it you see powerful movements of the masses, which all break apparently out of a clear sky, as in China and particularly in Korea. And our problem that confronts us as revolutionists is, shall we observe these events? Or shall we try to understand them and participate in them? That's the difference between the revolutionary approach and the spectator's approach. And if we don't participate in these events and in these struggles, regardless of what leadership they may have at the moment, we will never be able to influence them. That's the central thought at the bottom of all the discussion taking place in our ranks and unfolding with great clarity. It has been said here many times, repeated again by Comrade DeHary correctly, that Stalinism is the central question of this period. Certainly it is. And that's because in the absence of a sufficiently strong revolutionary political movement, these irrepressible uprisings of the masses find themselves, for the time being, under the control or the influence of the leadership of the Stalinists. But that doesn't alter the fact that they are revolutionary movements. That doesn't alter the fact that the masses are not imbued with any desire to work in Stalin's forced labor camps. They want to overthrow the conditions of life which are unbearable for them. And sometimes they push things to the point of taking power. That's what we think happened in Yugoslavia. That's what is the evidence before our eyes. And when fact after fact is piled up before us, this is what happened, it's been verified. There was a civil war. The bourgeoisie was defeated in the civil war. The proletarian brigades defeated the invading Nazis and the Chetniks. They set up an apparatus of a new state power. They expropriated the bourgeoisie. They smashed the power of the church. They nationalized industry. We say, all these are facts, aren't they? And then somebody says, well, you can't call that a revolution. Why? Because you have a theory that a centrist party cannot lead a revolution. And your theory prohibits you from recognizing the Yugoslav revolution. Well, my answer to that is very simple. I am not merely as big a trap as you think. My answer is, I don't have any theories that prohibit me from recognizing facts and trying to deal with them. And as a matter of fact, there is no law that I know of to the effect that under certain exceptional conditions, a centrist party cannot find itself at the head of a revolution in its early stages. I know that Marx and after him Engels, or after him Lenin and Trotsky, considered the communists a Paris Commune, a revolution and a dictatorship of the proletariat. Yet in the leadership of the Commune, the members of Marx's First International were a small minority, and the Marxists in the Fourth International faction were a minority of that. But that didn't prevent them from saying that that was the first worker state. And that didn't prevent Lenin from analyzing it more profoundly later and saying the reason that the revolution wasn't carried through to success. The decisive reason, in his opinion, was precisely the fact that a revolutionary party was not forged in time to lead it through to victory. I don't consider this a law that under certain conditions the workers can take power without beforehand a party of the Fourth International having gained the leadership of the majority of the working class. I don't consider that a law. I believe on the basis of all the experience from the Russian Revolution through Hungary, and by the way, what is the Hungarian Revolution? I think we always recognized that as a revolution, didn't we? And yet, the power there wasn't taken by a revolutionary party. It was delivered into the hands of the Communist Party by the bourgeoisie when the communist leaders were in jail, and they set up a government in coalition with the Social Democrats in the short-lived Hungarian Revolution. Now, the generalization that Trotsky and others drew from the later experience was that this coalition with the Social Democrats was a fatal error, and that, generally speaking, the idea that a reformist or centrist party can lead a revolution against the bourgeoisie through to completion is not correct. It may start that way because the revolutionary impulses of the masses and the disintegration of the bourgeois power on the other side may proceed at such a rate that the climactic struggle emerges before the revolutionary party is ready. But if the party in power does not follow a revolutionary policy, does not in time get on the revolutionary track and stay there, the revolution can be defeated. Revolution is not, as we understand it, a single act performed on one day, but a long process of getting the power and of keeping it and developing it through to conclusion. Now, when anything like this takes place anywhere, we have to recognize it and participate in it. That's what we're doing in Yugoslavia. We are not capitulating to the idea that Stalinists can lead a revolution and that therefore we have no historical role to play. I agree entirely with what Harry said, that the Yugoslav Communist Party, when it took the power, and by the fact that it did take the power, had broken basically with Stalinism. But we are participating in this revolution right now. By our support on the one hand, by our criticism on the other, we're trying to live up to our responsibility as a revolutionary party responsible for the further development of the Yugoslav revolution. And it's not excluded that we will have success. The criticism, the support, the arguments of the Fourth International are being read by some people in Yugoslavia. They, to a certain extent, perhaps are influenced by them. At any rate, that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to take our part of the responsibility and by no means abstaining from it. Now, I don't want to repeat at great length what has already been developed here. But it's a fundamental to this understanding of Stalinism. The understanding or misunderstanding of Stalinism is decisive for a revolutionary policy or otherwise. I fully agree with that. And I think what's the trouble with the Stalinophobes of all kinds, what renders them absolutely helpless in the face of revolutionary tasks, is they didn't understand Stalinism. That it's not a world monolith. That Stalinism is a Russian nationalist phenomenon primarily. That the world Stalinist movement, especially when it comes into under the pressure of great masses, and especially when it's confronted with the problems of power, has to break with the Russian Stalinism. And therefore ceases to that extent to be Stalinist. I was amazed and my hair almost stood on end when I heard this pronouncement from the papal throne here yesterday about Stalinism is the syphilis of the labor movement, the gravedigger of the revolution. There are 2,000 Communist Party members in France, 22.5 million in Italy. Are you going to make a revolution in Italy or France without these 2.5 million Stalinist workers or Stalinist sympathizers? And is Stalinism something that gets into one's blood, even the blood of a worker, and you can never cure it? Or is Stalinism simply a misunderstanding as far as the workers are concerned, who think it means revolution and who, when they find out it doesn't mean that, can be converted to a different political organization? On the other side, I don't think we should entertain any false ideas as to the role of Stalinism, even in the event of a new war. The idea that the new war is a worldwide class struggle in which the leadership comes from the Soviet Union is profoundly false. Profoundly false. Bert made an excellent point yesterday that even in the midst of the war, the revolutionary workers will have to fight Stalinism for their lives. That wherever the workers try to take power into their own hands, even in the midst of the war, they'll have to contend with a military force of the Stalinists. In the midst of the war, Stalin will try to sell out any revolution in a deal with the imperialists rather than let the Yugoslavian example spread widely. Imagine a proletarian revolution in Italy and France in which a genuine workers' power is established. Imagine Stalinism leading that civil war. Oh, that is a monstrous illusion. Stalin's guns will be turned on that war, even in collaboration with the imperialists. I should say that's a matter of course. That's the example of the last World War. We know that in the United States, before our very eyes, you even had that in Buffalo, I think, that in the alliance with the American bourgeoisie, they turned everything they had against the American workers' movement. They're not leaders of the class struggle against capitalism. They are defenders of the Soviet bureaucracy and its privileges against the international revolution and, to the extent necessary, against the bourgeoisie. But they are always willing to compromise with the bourgeoisie, but they're never willing to compromise with the workers. But you cannot fight Stalinism by cursing it and turning your back on it. Every place the movement develops under Stalinist influence, as in the Orient, as in Yugoslavia, as in France or Italy or any place else, we can only effectively fight Stalinism by participating in the genuine movement as partisans of the movement, and every inch we succeed in pushing it on a genuine revolutionary path, that's the strongest blow to deal against Stalinism. And that's the way it will be eventually destroyed. I believe that's the basic thought behind the collective opinion of our international comrades, as well as by the leaders of our party. One remarkable thing comes out of this discussion, that in all the world analysis, in the frank confrontation of new facts, unforeseen and unknown, the Trotsky analysis is the only one who sees and looks for, at every new contradictory development, the prospects of revolutionary action. That's what we did in Korea. And what a miserable record every other tendency showed. What a miserable record. Abstain in the Korean fight against the American imperialist gangsters and still talk about revolution and still talk about fighting Stalinism? No, that's abdication. Here's another remarkable fact. That Trotskyism, which has been accused of capitulating to Stalinism for the last 25 years, Trotskyism is the only set of ideas and methods that's been able to create a revolutionary movement in the world. You know of any other? I don't know of any other. I know of others who made pretensions, but I don't even hear much of the pretensions anymore. But Trotskyism everywhere remained a revolutionary party, didn't capitulate to Stalinism, and did not capitulate to the imperialists either. Now, how's that explained? How's that to be explained that a party who is wrong on the basic political problem of the epoch, the understanding of Stalinism, we're told we're completely wrong on that. If we're wrong on that, we're bound to be wrong on everything. How is it this party was wrong on the basic question and wrong on its understanding of the crisis of leadership, which is the second important question, has nevertheless, in spite of that, been able to create revolutionary parties all over the world and is the only tendency that could do it? I'd like to hear that explanation. And I'd like to see the comrades who give us warnings about the great catastrophe that awaits us. I'd have them stop and consider. We heard all these kind of warnings and ultimatums, as Harry said, for the 10 years or so he's been in the movement, and I heard it for the 10 years before that. What happened to all these people who gave us all the warnings about capitulating to Stalinism? As far as I know, every one of them, all the numerous factions and oppositions and split-offs that we had, who lost their heads over Stalinism, they all became at the very least bankrupt when it comes to dealing with living events. Nothing to say, no intervention in Yugoslavia, no recognition of the tremendous upheaval taking place in China, and no idea of participating in it. Not even a positive line on the classic action in Korea, which was a real test for everybody with a semblance of revolutionary realism. All we see from all other tendencies has been either abstention or support of imperialism. Everybody that went crazy on Stalinism either became an abstentionist or a capitulator to imperialism. The latest detachment, you read the Shachmanite press, in their national committee, they got a faction which calmly proposes to support American imperialism in its war for the liberation of the Korean people. And the others abstain. We, on the other hand, have an active policy of intervention. And I'll admit we have been late with some of our answers. We've been late in recognizing reality. But I think we're beginning to catch up. And we mustn't permit ourselves any more tardiness. And I don't believe we will need to. Because the thought of the international is merging toward a general agreement and is guarding itself against useless fights over terminological distinctions, as has been stated here. Great work has been done. I mention this only because the bugaboo that has been given to us in the documents of the Johnsonites about Pablo. Next to Stalin, our greatest thing to fear is Pablo, they tell us. That bugaboo doesn't scare me in the least. I just want to make that clear. As far as I can judge, and I read everything with the greatest attention, the best thinking, the boldest and clearest thinking that has been done with the complicated problems of the post-war era have been led, in my opinion, by Pablo. But I don't belong to any Pablo church, and I don't agree with him on every point. I disagree with his unfortunate expression about centuries of degenerated worker states. You'll have to correct that. I disagree with him when he said something, used the unfortunate expression about the impossibility of a war in the near future. Where we disagree, we make it clear. But I'm speaking about the method of thinking, the attempt to recognize the new reality with open eyes and try to see in that new developing reality the basis, not for a capitulation against Stalinism, but for a new struggle against it. I believe we're more effective in the struggle against Stalinism if we proceed that way than if we turn our backs and abstain, wash our hands of the whole nasty business. I would like to conclude by one warning to the comrades from Buffalo. I don't believe that Comrade Marcy is in any sense at all a Stalinist conciliator. I don't believe that. But I believe the theory he's propounding can influence less sturdy people in that direction. I think his theory has got to be radically changed. They got to give up the idea that all the thinking on the international problems is being done in Buffalo. It's being done on a worldwide scale, and we got to learn from each other. And woe to the man who will not learn. Woe to the stubborn. Nobody can prevent being in error now and then. Nobody can prevent mistakes, but the man who gets stubborn in his mistakes and persists in them, he's in a bad way. I hope that as a result of the discussion in the convention and the subsequent discussion, that all comrades will learn from each other, and we'll have emerging a real collective thinking of the great problems, resulting in a general agreement fully in line with the great traditions and principles of our movement.
I want to thank those who have made it possible for me to speak at this convention. I am grateful to them. I shall spend a few minutes discussing what we take up in the section of our bulletin on the theory of the party. We did not make it clear enough in this bulletin, even to some of the comrades of our tendency. Note, please, that I am saying this with regard to the theory of the party. On the question of the program of the party, the need of a program for the party, there has been no doubt or uncertainty where we stand. From the beginning of the discussion and at the beginning of our document, we made this clear. And Comrade Monin has said all that needs to be said for us on this. Nor are we introducing new ideas as to how the Socialist Workers' Party is to be built. We are not saying that the leadership is giving a wrong line or following a wrong tactic on this or any other question. That is not our theory nor our practice. And I think I can safely say that the comrades know that that is neither our theory or our practice. In this section on the theory of the party, we were pointing out that the Stalinists, the whole gigantic state apparatus of Stalinism and of world Stalinism, are propagating a special theory of the party. It is propagated in every field: political economy, philosophy, art, literature, in political practice and in political theory, in book after book, pamphlet after pamphlet, day in and day out. But you don't have to read these books and pamphlets to be aware of the Stalinist theory of the party. Not at all. Every worker is aware of, and the general public is aware and interested in this theory of the party. The Stalinist theory of the one party bureaucratic state. And we were saying that we the Revolutionary Party, have to oppose that conception. Now here we broke new ground. We want to say that frankly. What we were trying to say in that section was this. Today, bureaucracy is the fundamental form of capitalism. The result is that the labor movement, which becomes corrupted by capitalism, takes on that form and becomes completely bureaucratized. The two parties that we, the Revolutionary Party, have to fight, for whose overthrow we have to prepare, the social democracy and the Stalinists, are distinguished by the fact that they consciously aim at imposing bureaucratic domination over the working class. That is the Stalinist conception of the party in particular. They have not got the Leninist conception any longer or any adaptation of it. They mean totalitarian, one-party, bureaucratic domination. And they say, and we believe that our theory of the party should be such that whoever reads it will be able to say this. I do not know too much about Trotskyism. I do not believe in communism at all. But it is perfectly clear from what these Trotskyists say that they have a totally different conception of the party and the role of the party from that which the Stalinists have. We say that many people, and I know this from personal experience, say that the difference between us and the Stalinists is that we claim we would be democratic, while the Stalinists are totalitarian. Note, I am not talking of democracy in our party here. I am speaking of democracy when the power is seized. And we try to say that it is not a question of they, the Stalinists, being undemocratic, while we, the Trotskyists, are democratic. It is a question of social struggles, of social functions, of a whole social formation at this stage of capitalism, and of the role of the masses in that. And we say also that this is extremely clear in Comrade Trotsky's conception of the Labor Party. That is all that I have to say on this. I am speaking here briefly and simply for the purposes of clarification.
Comrade Chairman and comrades, Comrade Cannon, in his speech, fixed the source of the undoubted confusion and doubts in the minds of many comrades on the fact that there are some who believe that a centrist party cannot lead a proletarian revolution. I hope he is correct, because in that case we shall have no difficulties. To help clear up that particular aspect of the confusion, I want to say that at no time, either in discussions in the committee or in my presentations, that I ever want to have any comrade get the idea that a centrist party that evolves even from underneath the leaden lid of Stalinism can lead a revolution. I'm afraid that the real source of the confusion goes much deeper. The confusion you refer to, I think, can be cleared up very simply. I think it arises from the fact that the formula that you propose to characterize the events in Yugoslavia does not set the limits to what a centrist movement can accomplish and cannot. It arises from the undoubted self-contradiction of a proletarian revolution unfolding for which we take complete responsibility, in which we seek to participate in every possible way we can, which we support unconditionally, led by a leadership
for which we take no political responsibility. We take no political responsibility not only for the Yugoslav Communist Party and its policies, we take no responsibility for the policies of the Yugoslav regime. Isn't that so? Now what does that mean? That regime now appears as the work, as the comrades want to say, an expression of the worker state. And that's the trouble, that's the whole trouble. Set limits to what such a leadership can do, because we're in complete agreement that the continuation of these policies can only lead to destruction. The limits of such a leadership must be recognized in your formula characterizing the stage of the process which the proletarian revolution has reached. What are these limits? In my opinion, and here I am condensing the differences as clearly as I am able, such a regime can only set up a succession of dual power systems in its leadership of the proletarian revolution. That is to say, continue a condition of social crisis which can be eliminated by the only historic and necessary guarantee. And what is that? What is that guarantee? That guarantee is the leadership and the policy which the Russian Revolution had. That is to say, the guarantee which only the Trotskyist movement can give. Now, there's no disagreement on this in the resolution itself. We characterize the party as centrist and propose no change in that, I am sure. How much?
You got about 4 more minutes.
4 more minutes, good. Now, I wish also I could agree with the conception that if we adopt the formula of the worker state, that would somehow enable us to intervene more actively. Push that revolution forward, guarantee its success. I say, I wish I could believe it, because that would be so easy. That would be so good. That would be really a weapon in our hands. But you've had the practice of experience already. The international movement and our own movement has been treating that in terms of the dictatorship of the proletariat, has been treating that in terms of a victorious proletarian revolution. And yet, what do we find in a recent period? We find ourselves not only coming to, but actually in, the sharpest collision politically with precisely that regime. And we explain, and mind you, comrades, I think we are being too sharp. We are being too sharp in our criticisms, because we are not only addressing the regime, we are addressing the mass of the people, the revolutionists, to follow that regime. We can't come to them and say your system will die. We've got to come to them with the truth. We'll say you want to protect the conquests of your revolution, which is also ours, which we want, we're going to defend to the death with you. Look at the policies that are followed. These are not correct policies. These policies are necessary. They're historically necessary. They're politically necessary. They're a life and death question. Look at the experience of your own leadership, and so forth and so on. Now, I hope I have made my point clear enough. I don't think I should take the time of the convention any further. The aim of this entire discussion is precisely to do what Comrade Cannon put so plainly. Intervene in that discussion. He saw no serious threat of faction. I didn't see any threat at all. I was surprised that only a very small number of comrades even suggested that the elections in their branches should take place on the basis of the different motivations. To prevent that possibility, I did not introduce a counter-resolution. We don't need methods of warfare to settle disagreements in our movement. We need entirely different forms. We don't need to set up systems of dual power inside our own party, create conditions of crisis. There is no crisis in our party. nor in the international, and there won't be. Precisely because of that, I presented my point of view as a memorandum. And precisely because of that, I propose to follow the following course to avert any possible idea that any government may have that I personally will lead any faction on disagreements concerning the actual phase of the revolution, how we can best intervene. Anybody has any such idea, forget it. And those contemptible people who have the nerve to get up and say, psychologically analyze it, it's a fear to be in a minority. I not only resent that, I tell you, I spit in your face. I propose that those comrades who agree with the views I've presented, that they abstain with the memorandum. That's not abstentionism in their sense at all. We don't want to vote no. A no vote's a vote of no confidence in the leadership. Why should? Any comment, Mr. Greenberg? I believe that in all our actions, we must be responsible above all for the course of our party. And that's why I propose to follow the method I have just outlined to you.
Colonel Murray.
Comrades, I think it was a very good discussion on related questions on Yugoslavia. It is essential that the convention start the discussion that we had here, or at least raise the discussion that we've had over the last period to a new point. From different points of view, sometimes from fundamentally different points of view, comrades have said that the main question is Stalinism. But from the point of view of all the Trotskyists, the question of Stalinism is the question of the destruction, the breakup, the annihilation of Stalinism. We don't make any split between our evaluation and our task. As we deepen our evaluation and grapple with every new form of the reality, it is constantly intertwined for us with new forms of struggle. The suggestion that the problem before us is to understand Stalinism or to make some declaration on Stalinism, a subject which we have concealed our views upon, is of course ludicrous. And I'll deal with that, although many speakers have adequately taken up that point. Our comrade Burt, I thought, made a very interesting point in his discussion. He said that by and large we are narrowing down the difference to a terminological one or even to a quibble. He said he understands that by our recent discussion we are coming to agreement that what is involved is the integration, assimilation, or any other word you want to use, of this area into the Soviet or into the Russian structure. That's been the method, it seems to me, of all the comrades internationally, aside from all the by points in the discussion, in attempting to evaluate Eastern Poland, Eastern Europe. That's the nature of the process. We have guarded carefully against attempting to construct a whole new evaluation of Stalinism, an entire epoch, a qualitative difference, a upon the basis of the phenomena in Eastern Europe. An altogether different argument is with the Johnsonites, who enter the discussion on the buffer zone precisely with that motivation. In effect, what they're saying is, if the Kremlin is capable, through bureaucratic and military methods, of seizing territory after it's made a deal with imperialism at the expense of the working class, and by bureaucratic military methods incorporating areas into the Soviet Union, then you have granted, they tell us, a new quality to Stalinism, and then what is the role of the Fourth International? We reject that whole approach to the question. And that's the basic point with regard to Eastern Europe. To then attempt to imply that we are setting up a series of exceptions is to not understand that reality does not conform to very simple and even simple-minded formulas. This is not the first time we witness this complex refraction of historical laws, the nature of certain phenomena in real history. There is no reason whatsoever, and this was the shading of our dispute, it seems to me, in America, and in the worldwide discussion up to now, there's no reason whatsoever on the basis of the phenomena of Eastern Europe to construct a qualitatively new analysis of Stalinism. It doesn't relieve us of the problem of facing each and every question, exceptional questions, from this central standpoint. Now, Comrade Burt, in his reference to the riddle, I can't pronounce that other word, conundrum, the riddle that the Johnsonites pose about what is the role of the Fourth International, gave a very good answer. I think he explained better than I did just exactly what our approach is to the question. By the same token, I would ask all those comrades who participated in this discussion with us what fundamental differences or even what secondary differences remain between us. If it's settled that we're not dealing with a qualitative distinction, that Eastern Europe represents a manifestation of bureaucratic military action of the Stalinists and not some new mode of revolution, fundamentally new, and I think we can work out the question and further discussion, pay attention to all details and all facts, and I think we'll have a deepening of this atmosphere in the discussion of scientific, detached concern for the truth facing every question that arises. I'd like to ask the comrades of the Johnson Forest tendency, whom did you debate with in your document? You got everything turned around. It would appear that we have never said a word on Stalinism, whereas in our conception, our whole movement was founded and has developed precisely in the evaluation, analysis, and struggle against Stalin. After a certain period in the party, you present a proposal that we do away with the whole conception that our movement has developed about Stalinism for a number of reasons. Central among these is that we now have to understand the whole world that we live in from the standpoint of the theory of state capitalism. We then propose to take up your challenge to our program, which doesn't have to be written for the first time, and suddenly you aren't there. Now, I never had a pope to get rid of, so perhaps I don't have the passion on this question. Carmack Cannon has. But I, too, am very irritated with this hide-and-seek method in the discussion. Perhaps they listened too carefully to one of the most famous mixed metaphors ever pronounced at our conventions. And I think on the trade union report, one of our comrades said, when you get into hot water, either unfurl your banner or pull in your arms. I think that the comrade should have added, don't try doing all three things at once. I also object to this method of implying that there's some undelineated wisdom yet to come. That you have to go on to the more esoteric documents. That's not just for any old discussion like at a national convention. We'll bide our time. I had sympathy with a comrade who expressed the feeling that he would feel happier about this process if it was really working out that way in the party. But it not only irritates, it infuriates comrades who have been trained in the program and method of our movement, who suddenly find that among the youth of the party, there are those who have gone through a basic training course in state capitalism before they have even begun to approach the fundamental documents and methods of Trotskyism. And there is even no discussing with them. And they got all the tactics and strategy of this abstentionism in the discussion, all down pat. That doesn't make for the approach that sometime in the future we will discuss these basic questions. I incidentally owe an apology to the Los Angeles Johnson Forest comrades, because I thought that was a local quirk on their part. We came into the pre-convention discussion with the disposition to start with the fundamental questions as we have been taught. Yes, philosophy, political economy, historical materialism, the nature of the epoch, the nature of the party, the nature of Stalinism, imperialism. We were rather grateful that these fundamental questions were posed. And when we opened the discussion on these points under one heading or another, the comrades said, why, you're provoking. It's provocation. We want to discuss program. And one comrade very aptly said, why, that reminds us of the Shacklinites in 1940. In the face of differences which were rooted in theoretical propositions and had to be resolved on the basis of theoretical propositions, you can't take up, as Comrade Frederick says, in total contradiction to the whole procedure, secondary question. And the nature of Stalinism, incidentally, is not the fundamental question with you. That's a derivative question also. If we discuss with you for 2 days the nature of Stalinism, we'd still have to go into the whole nature of the epoch, classes, what a bureaucracy is. I think it would be better to come off it and to discuss the questions that have been posed in their most fundamental essence. I personally believe the movement will gain by it. And we'll begin to see daylight in this problem only through such a discussion. I think Comrade Cannon has already touched on the Pablo question. It seems to be the clever strategy in this discussion to say, you're rushing into the arms of Pablo. That's supposed to frighten. In Los Angeles, I told the comrades that after two or three meetings on his rushing into the arms of Pablo, I told him, why, I'm in the arms of Pablo already. Let's get started from there. We don't see any distinction or any fundamental distinction between our thinking and Pablo's. I personally think there's been a lot of distortion about Kermit Pablo's point of view, even on disputed questions. I don't like this shorthand quotation method which says Pablo speaks about centuries of degenerated worker states. As I understand it, and I've reread and read the quotation involved, Kermit Pablo seems to me in an entirely unexpected way, and on a question which certainly can be debated, and I disagree with him, speaks about the period of transition from capitalism to socialism, which may last centuries, and then speaks about that in this period we will witness the appearance of deformed worker states, not corresponding to the norm. It's a disputable question, but to shorten that to say we're going to have centuries of degenerated worker states, I don't think that's a fair presentation of a Kermit's point of view. Now, another thing with regard to this method of the Johnson-Forrest tendency, they said in the discussion here, they repeated what they said in their document, that if it was merely a question of defeatism or defensism on Russia, they wouldn't bother with the problem. Why? Because that's something we can't do very much about. I think this reveals the whole method of this tendency. Defeatism or defensism on the Russian question, or on the Yugoslav question, or on the Korean question, that's the question of the class line of the party in all the unfolding events. That's the question of what our struggle will be, what our intervention will be, what the class nature of that intervention of the party will be. And to discount that question is insignificant because we don't know of how large the Russian Trotskyist movement is. Apparently that's the point. The worst empiricism. Now, I listened very carefully and with great interest to what Comrade Leo Stone had to say about the theory of the party. I don't think she does justice to her documents, to the document of the Johnson-Forrest tendency. If that was the question involved, that we have to explain more popularly, more clearly, to workers who are frightened and alarmed by the Stalinist conception of a party, we can settle that in 5 minutes, talk to the editors of our press and work out a better line on it. Is that what's involved in your theory of the party? You tell us what the Stalinist conception is. You mention the Leninist conception, which is ours. What is your conception? Do you forget the long passages in your document in which you say the First International had its conception of the party, second had its conception, the third a different one, and the fourth must now have a new one? Do you forget the references regarding the enlarging the concept of the party? We have studied that carefully, and it appears to us that you're dealing with a negation of the whole Bolshevik conception of the party. Particularly when you state so point blank that the whole cornerstone of our approach as contained in the transitional program is exactly the opposite of the truth. And finally, I would like to say to the Johnson-Forrest comrades that I was disappointed that I didn't hear at least a half a word about the export and import business. Because it's most interesting as you look into the question a little closer, that this glaring contradiction in this total conception of the world remains without an answer. It isn't simply that one country was left off the list. Some comrade pointed out to me, I think it was Joe, that the United States has 3/4 of the world's capital and 2/3 of its industrial plant. You're not dealing with a little corner of the earth. If the fundamental driving force of the imperialist epoch is expressed with such force in the United States, where does the whole thesis stand on the new stage of capitalism, which in this particular question has already revealed an entirely different form, not export, not excess of capital, shortage of capital, import. How can we understand the dynamics of American imperialism, its whole perspective in world economy, its military drive, its role in Europe? How can we understand that pivotal question, the relationship between Europe and America, or America and the whole world for that matter, if we are blind on this central point? Now I come to the question of Yugoslavia. I think that the main point I want to deal with, those are concerned, those comrades, and I think there are very many in the party, who have hesitations and doubts, many questions about Yugoslavia and our characterization. I think the central question they ask, I'm talking about Comrade Wright, who in his final remarks just did away with that question, the central question they ask is, how come that a centrist party led a workers' revolution to power? I got a note from some of the comrades which posed it point blank. They say, if you contend that the leadership, question of proletarian leadership, is the main problem, how do you square this with Yugoslavia, or the Yugoslav revolution being led by a non-Bolshevik and non-Trotskyist party, seize the power and establish the workers' state? The remarks of Comrade Cannon, I think, introduce the essence of our approach to this question. I was reminded of the opposite formulation of this question in our dispute with the Maroites, where they said there are no revolutionary situations in Europe. Why? Because there's no revolutionary party. Without a revolutionary party, you can't have a revolutionary situation. They too made the fundamental mistake. Archive their fundamental statements from the entire process and its movement in history or in economics are absolutely not understandable if you attempt to reverse them in that static form. When we sum up the whole epoch that we have lived in by saying that without a revolutionary world party, the victory of the world proletarian revolution or the victory of the revolution in any given country is not possible, I don't think we have to retreat one inch on that. But we have to understand not a vulgar interpretation of that law. The Paris Commune example is not unimportant, because it contains both aspects of the problem, both how a working class in its infancy could arrive at power without the conscious factor being present in full force, or even without it being present to any great degree, and how it falls because of the same reason. In Yugoslavia today, your question about a centrist party taking the power is being answered in life and in struggle in this manner. Without a revolutionary party that understands fundamentally Bolshevism, the recent right swing in foreign policy is an indication. There can be no successful revolution. Just as we cannot freeze the revolution to a single date in Yugoslavia, so can we unravel and freeze each separate stage of the revolution inclusive of tomorrow. This whole process in which you have a complicated interrelation between the party and the masses, the subjective and objective factors, are being worked out.